You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 133 by Rudolf Steiner, 9 Lectures, entitled Earthly and Cosmic Man, translated by Dorothy Osmond and Clifford Venno. This is Lecture 4, given in Berlin on April 23, 1912. Before we turn to the subject of our study today, I must first draw your attention to the Anthroposophical Calendar, which has just been published, and in which I have attempted to re-enliven what a calendar can be for the human being. For in this calendar, the cycles of time, the relationships of forces and cycles of time, are led back to their origins, through which they can be recognized in occult imaginations. Much of what is expressed today only in the abstract symbols of the images of the zodiac can be enlivened. If what was originally meant by the images of the zodiac is transformed into an imagination that can be felt. This has been done in the renewed zodiacal images rendered by the sensitive intuition of Fräulein von Eckhartstein, so that one can once again feel one's way into a living relationship with the heavens. You must only try to bring to life feelingly within yourselves what is given in the images. You then find meditative formulas for the individual weeks of the year. These meditative formulas are particularly recommended for you because they contain that which can be brought to life in the soul and which then truly corresponds to a living relationship of soul forces to the forces of the macrocosm. What we could call the progress of time is directed and guided by spiritual beings, who in their living mutual relationships actually determine time. One could even say make time. Now, it is entirely abstract and merely allegorical when the human experience of time, the element of time in the human soul, is likened, without further ado, to processes that relate to time in the macrocosm. You will see the totally different experiences of the human soul, which, in a certain sense, have nothing to do with time, are given there. If you bring these things to life in your souls, then you will come to know the relationship that the soul can experience between the center and the periphery of sensory experiences. This peculiar relationship can be altered through these meditations. An imagination of the relationships of beings who determine the course of time can thereby be called forth, so that in these 52 formulas one can in fact find the way from the microcosm to the macrocosm. The calendar's outer form is only the exoteric side, for in truth we write 1879. The relationships of time that can be seen through occult observation should really be brought to expression here. This should have a starting point here, for, naturally, it is only a first beginning. With the mystery of Golgotha, the birth of I, capital, consciousness, is given within humanity. And this fact will be increasingly understood in the spiritual culture of our earth as having significance for the whole future of humanity. Thus, one will gradually understand that it is justified to consider our current year to be 1879, that is, 1912 minus 33. This also means that time is calculated from Easter to Easter, that we do not begin with January. For if one sees in the birth of I consciousness something essential for the spiritual evolution of humanity, it is also justified to be reminded every year of this fact by relating this birth of I-consciousness itself to the relationships between the microcosm and the macrocosm. A significant aspect of the relationship between microcosm and macrocosm is given when the Easter festival is thought of in connection with the birth of I-consciousness. The fact that today there is an attempt to set the date of Easter on a fixed day, rather than reading the date from the heavens, belongs quite naturally to the signature of our time, which, in regard to all external relationships, enters ever deeper into materialism and forgets what is connected with the spiritual. It will perhaps be necessary that over against industrialism, commercialism, and materialism in general, a remembrance is preserved in the anthroposophical stream, a remembrance of the concrete dates, which are not given through payment by cash or check, but through the relationships of the universe. If the date of Easter is no longer set in accordance with the world of the stars, it will be the first great sign that the outer and inner culture, the completely materialistic and spiritualistic tracks, must go entirely side by side. One would stand before a hopeless prospect if one believed that from out of the materialistic culture a real ascent to spiritual facts is possible. This is a first attempt for this year. I hope that the fact that anthroposophists use the calendar will support us in bringing it before the world in an ever more perfect form. During the last few weeks, a number of friends from Germany have been with me on a visit to a field of theosophical work abroad, to Helsinki in Finland. A visit of this kind to a far-off field of work always brings a realization of the unity of theosophical life all over the globe, and also of its deep roots in the culture of the present day. It meant a great deal to me when our friends in Finland expressed the wish that I should speak to them about the venerable Finnish epic, the Kalevala. As this wish was conveyed to me some time ago, I was able to occupy myself from the vantage point of occultism with this remarkable poem of the Finns, who are themselves in many respects a unique people. And this brought to the fore once again things of which I have spoken on other occasions, here and also elsewhere. A very definite experience comes to us when, independently of everything people have hitherto known concerning the spiritual worlds, and have in their own way expressed in words, we ourselves strive for deeper insight into those worlds and man's relationship to them, and ask, how are we to understand what is contained in the many folk traditions that have been preserved through the centuries? How are we to apply to these recorded traditions the knowledge we have acquired concerning the supra-sensory world? Although their language differs from that in which they have to be presented today, biblical and other records clearly, based upon occult foundations, are expressions issuing from ancient times and from manifold periods of human evolution of wisdom and knowledge, which it is possible for us to rediscover today. These ancient records present a new aspect and seem to be imbued with a new power. When we realize that in and from those same worlds to which we aspire along the path to spiritual knowledge and to initiation, great revelations have been given to the world in different epochs and in many ways, we may well feel that the venerable Finnish epic, the Kalevala, has a special and unique occult significance. My own experience was very vivid and definite. This Finnish epic has been translated into every European language, but it differs fundamentally and significantly from all other epic poems. No comparison with any of them is possible. When my book titled Theosophy first appeared many years ago, independent observation of the spiritual world had led me to member the human soul into three, sentient soul, mind or intellectual soul, consciousness soul. Knowledge of the threefold soul was acquired purely through occult research and occult observation, directed to the spiritual world quite independently of any tradition. Occult research was the only source consulted. And now, because our friends in the Finnish section desired me to speak of the occult meaning of the Kalevala, it was necessary to make the poem the subject of spiritual investigation. It has been emphasized repeatedly that human consciousness and the life of soul were not always as they are today. In primeval times of the evolution of mankind, our present mode of perception and thinking, our present relationship to the external world, simply did not exist. In those ancient times, the human being was endowed with a natural, innate clairvoyance. Turning our gaze to past epochs in the evolutionary process, we come to a period, starting about the year 600 BC, when man's life of soul began to assume the form and character which were subsequently to lead to the much more abstract, scientific mode of thinking. Before that time, vestiges and remains of the old clairvoyance, or memories of it, at least, persisted among certain peoples for a very long time, among others for not so long. When we look back into the development of the peoples, we find in every case that consciousness, as it is at present, developed only by very gradual stages. In very ancient times, normal human consciousness was imbued with a certain form of clairvoyance. And it was during the period of twilight, denoting the disappearance of the old clairvoyance and the first beginnings of modern consciousness, that the national epics, the folk epics, came to birth. It would, of course, have been absolutely impossible for people of primeval times to know anything about the threefoldness represented by sentient soul, mind, soul, consciousness, soul. But they possessed genuine clairvoyance, although it was dim and dreamlike, lacking the light of intellect and reason in their present form. Before the dawning of the consciousness we know today, there were conditions, midway, as it were, between our waking and sleeping states, in which living memories arose of entirely different circumstances of life. When the relation of one human being to another was determined not by anything like consciousness as it is at present, but by the old clairvoyance. And in their great folk epics, the peoples depicted the experiences which arose within them during the period when the old clairvoyance was dying away and present-day consciousness was beginning to dawn. The materialist says that man's life of soul has unfolded by degrees out of the material processes in the human organism, out of processes which are also to be found in lower forms of life. Spiritual science, however, makes it clear that the elements of soul life, as they are in the animal, would never have been able to give rise to the threefoldness of sentient soul, mind soul, consciousness soul, and that it is far more a matter of this inner trinity of the three members of the soul having flowed down from a spiritual world. Therefore, when we look into the spiritual world, we can speak of three downflowing streams with which three beings in the spiritual worlds are connected, beings who are the direct inspirers of the sentient soul, the mind soul, and the consciousness soul. We have to think of the creators of these three manifestations of the life of soul in that supersensory world with which in primeval times human beings were in direct communion. We know that the moment our consciousness rises into the spiritual world, no matter whether this is the result of deliberate training, as will be the case today, or whether through the old clairvoyance the human form becomes an imagination. In those olden days, too, the soul attained to a form of imagination, beholding in pictures the outpouring of the threefold human soul from the spiritual world. The Finnish epic tells of these three heroes. To begin with, these three beings seem strange and remarkable in the highest degree. They have something superhuman about them, and at the same time something that graduates into the genuinely human. But if we examine the matter more closely, and with occult means, it becomes apparent that these three figures, these three heroes, are the creators and inspirers of the threefold powers of the soul in man. The creator of the sentient soul is the figure to whom in the Kalevala the name of Väinämöinen is given. The creator of the mind soul is Ilmarinen, and the creator of the consciousness soul, Lemminkainen. And so in the national epic of this remarkable people, we find in a form of imagination springing from the original ancient clairvoyance what is rediscovered by modern spiritual research. The human being of today has the outer form we see before us only because the foundations of this threefold life of soul were laid down in the course of evolution on Earth. I indicated this in the public lectures given in the Berlin Architektenhaus, titled The Origin of Man in the Light of Spiritual Science, on January 4, 1912, and titled The Origin of the Animal World in the Light of Spiritual Science, on January 18, 1912. We must picture to ourselves that there was a time in the process of the Earth's development when neither human beings nor animals were in existence, when all that was present was a kind of undifferentiated, in quotes, substance. The beings who first detached themselves were those which have reached the animal stage. When all the animals were there, man was still waiting until other conditions of earth existence had set in. And because he had waited for these other conditions, he was able to become the recipient of his present form. In other words, while the animals developed their various forms on the earth, man remained in the spiritual world above. His development began only when the animals had already assumed their destined forms. The foundations of the threefold soul, sentient soul, mind soul, consciousness soul, were laid in man, and it was then possible for him to enter earth existence in the external form in which he now lives. With this in mind, we can say, man is the created being we know today, sent down the animal kingdom before him, and then followed himself, when the earth conditions were such that he could bring to manifestation, in outer form, the threefold life of soul that had been laid into his being. What does this really mean? Knowledge of these occult truths restores to the traditions of religion, which rest upon occult foundations, their ancient value and meaning. Man received earthly substance into himself when he was able to recast, to remold it into his present form, a form able to receive the imprint of the threefold life of soul. Thus man elaborated earthly substance according to the laws of his life of soul, made earthly substance subject to the plan underlying his life of soul, and became the earthly man. He fashioned earthly substance after the model of the threefold prototypal soul. Think of the biblical picture of the molding of the substance of earth, not the dust, but the substance of earth, into man. We now discern profound meaning in this biblical conception, upon which so much scorn has been poured by modern enlightenment, as it is called. For the passage points to the time when the animals, having descended at an earlier period, were already in existence, and when, out of earthly substance, the being who now stands before us as bodily man was fashioned at a later stage, according to the model of the soul. It is wonderful to find this process presented in the Kalevala, with great imaginative power, as the forging of a mysterious instrument called the Sampo. The most curious explanations have been given of this mysterious instrument, the Sampo. In reality, it is the human etheric body, forged by the interworking of the three soul members. It is the etheric body, the imprint of which is the physical body. All that is necessary here is to give indications, without entering more closely into details. The national epic of Finland quite obviously derives from the memory of the Finnish people, in which clairvoyant perceptions of ancient times had been retained. Through these perceptions, some knowledge still persisted of the descent of man as a being of soul, a threefold soul, into the physical body. What is noteworthy in such a matter is that in the old heroic sagas of humanity, we again find the truths and knowledge acquired today of the spiritual worlds. The Kalevala is an example of what is to be found in many ancient records of importance to humanity, and is, moreover, one that emerged from oblivion only in the 19th century. For it had been entirely forgotten and was compiled during the course of that century from folk songs extant among the Finnish people. In the early years of the 19th century, nothing had been written down of the Kalevala as we possess it today. The songs were heard from the people and had lived only among them. The simple fact is that in the 19th century, a certain doctor realized that the people sang of many interesting things and set about collecting the songs. Then a compilation was made, and they assumed fresh importance. They attracted considerable attention and were translated into all the European languages. Scholars then proceeded to give senseless explanations of them. But all that really matters is that they are there, having lived among the people. Approaching the matter with the spiritual knowledge we possess today, it becomes apparent, if we are willing to recognize it, that in what had survived there among the people and was gathered from among them, there is occult content which can be rediscovered today, just as occult content can be rediscovered in Homer's Iliad, in the Odyssey, in the Nibelungenlied, and elsewhere. Only we must be willing to seek earnestly, not applying anything in the way of allegorical or symbolical interpretation, but rather allowing what is actually there to make its own impression upon us. What we ourselves have found in the realm of occultism shines forth in imaginations deriving from times of hoary antiquity. But in this case there is something of particular interest, as I myself discovered. When the Kalevala came into my hands, I heard that the closing runes, which make allusion to a connection between the spiritual life of ancient Finland and Christianity, must obviously have been a later addition. For whereas all the rest bears the character of ancient paganism, the closing runes introduce an essentially Christian element, but very delicately and lightly. And then, strangely enough, I discovered that this belongs fundamentally to the Kalevala, that the poem is inconceivable without these closing runes. This means that in its origin and life among the people, the Kalevala quite naturally culminated in a delicate reference to Christianity, and it may be added, to the most impersonal, non-Palestinian Christianity that it is possible to imagine, hardly recognizable by Christian concepts as they now are. Here, therefore, it is clear that from the same primeval soul there issued something that could not have been born at the same time as Christian culture among the other peoples of Europe. For Christian culture arose long after clairvoyance had still been able to look back to those primeval ages when the threefold soul was membered into the human form. And so, here among the Finnish people, we have an indication of the link between the ancient clairvoyance and the influence subsequently brought into play by Christian culture. This is something quite remarkable and unique, perhaps nowhere else to be found on earth. It may be that the veneration in which the Kalevala is held in Finland has preserved this epic from the fate that has befallen the Iliad. I do not know if many of you are aware that scholarship, first of all, hacked the Iliad into fragments and then declared that it was not written by a man bearing the name of Homer, indeed, that it was not the work of a single writer, but was only put together from collected songs later on. The Kalevala, of course, was actually a compilation, but nevertheless, it forms a complete whole, one coherent whole. Possibly in the future, a few changes here and there may be necessary, but nevertheless, it is complete in itself. And so we have before us here, gathered from the consciousness of the people, a number of occult imaginations. If we follow the matter in the Akasha Chronicle, we find that the Kalevala leads back to the ancient and sacred mysteries of Northern Europe, and that the truths it contains were inspired by the initiates, given forth to the people, and instilled into them. Why have I been telling you these things? Matters about which we have been hearing for years were also spoken of in Helsingfors, and will be spoken of in other parts of Europe too. But the public lecture, which I was able to give on the subject of the occult content of the folk epics, with particular reference to the Kalevala, was something new, especially belonging to Finland. One then realized that the essence of spiritual science will more and more make itself felt over the whole earth. For do we not all feel that with spiritual science we are at home in the spiritual life? We are everywhere at home, for spiritual science is the light which illumines the path to the spirit trodden by mankind all over the earth. It is an overpowering experience to rediscover through spiritual science the real content of this collection of folk poems that form themselves into one whole. We find how right on into the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries the folk soul became articulate in poetry, still possessing vital memories of the old clairvoyance once possessed by these unique Finnish peoples, who to this day retain many customs and arts reminiscent of an ancient form of magic. And then we realize that spiritual science alone can lead to an understanding of these things, make them intelligible to us. One of the many signs of the great spiritual happenings of the near future may be indicated in the following way. Spiritual science has taken us into the region of an entirely unknown tongue, for the Finnish language differs from all other European languages. Externally, one understands nothing of it, and it is like being transported into an absolutely strange land. What knowledge does spiritual science bring us? How does spiritual science enable us to speak with this people, who, so far as the last centuries are concerned, have remained remote from the other peoples of Europe? We speak with them about what is holiest and most sacred to them, and is now coming to life again so strongly that people are reaching out for the Kalevala, and the eyes of the whole world of culture are turning to it. In what is the most sacred possession of a people, we learn to understand the speech of the folk soul. So, too, it can be the whole world over when we realize what must be the very root nerve of theosophical life. We are standing on the threshold of a new disclosure of spiritual truths. Attention has often been drawn to this, above all in my Rosicrucian mystery play titled The Portal of Initiation. Reference is there made to the fact that times are approaching when human souls will become more and more open to receive revelations from the spiritual world, which will break in upon them as a kind of natural experience. In the course of the next 3,000 years, people will gradually grow into the spiritual world. Through spiritual science, however, we must learn to understand why and to what extent this will come about. In the first, very ancient period of the post-Atlantean era, that of the holy rishis of India, culture flowed, as it were, directly from and was inspired by the human etheric body. In the epoch of ancient Persia, culture was inspired by the sentient body, the astral body. In the Egypto-Chaldean epoch, by the sentient soul. In the Greco-Latin period, by the mind or intellectual soul. And in our own epoch, by the consciousness soul. There will follow a form of culture inspired by the spirit self, and so on. If you keep in your minds a picture of the whole course of post-Atlantean culture, you will find, as it were, a descending curve until the time of the Greco-Latin epoch. It is clearly perceptible and permits of no denial that this age represents the lowest point of man's descent to the physical plane. The most characteristic and remarkable feature of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch is that spiritual life is all interwoven, intertwined, entangled with life on the physical plane. But in that same epoch comes the impulse of the mystery of Golgotha, and necessarily so. You have only to think of what you already know in this connection. There is, however, something else of importance to remember. The actual course of human evolution comes to expression in manifold ways in the life of the individual. In the little book titled The Education of the Child in the Light of Spiritual Science, it is said that up to the seventh year, the development of the physical body is of primary importance. This phase corresponds in the evolutionary process of mankind as a whole to the period preceding the Atlantean catastrophe. The period of life between the seventh and the 14th years is a recapitulation, although veiled and obscured, of the culture connected with the etheric body, which reached its highest glory in the epoch of ancient India. The period from the 14th to the 21st year of life is a recapitulation of the culture inspired by the astral body, corresponding to the epoch of ancient Persia. The Egypto-Chaldean period is reflected in the life of the individual human being from the 21st to the 28th year, and the Greco-Latin epoch is reflected in the life of the individual between the 28th and 35th years. This is a very important period, for just as, at that time, post-Atlantean humanity swung over from a descending to an ascending culture, so there can be a turning point in the life of the individual between the 28th and the 35th years. At the middle point of his earthly existence, the individual faces at one and the same time a descending and an ascending curve of life. After the 35th year, he passes, as it were, into the period of outward decline, into a process of withering. In the individual human life at this time, there must be something which corresponds with the swing over from the descending to the ascending curve of culture. That the mystery of Golgotha took place during this particular period of the life of Christ Jesus, between the 28th and 35th years, was not a matter of chance. It could not be otherwise, as those who know anything of these connections will realize. The mystery of Golgotha could only be enacted during the period of life connected specifically with the development of the mind-soul. Since the end of the Middle Ages, we have passed into the period of the unfolding of the consciousness soul. This will last for a very long time, and then will come the period of the evolution of spirit self. Now, in the life of the individual, there is something irregular, magnificently irregular, about the appearance or awakening of the I, capital. At some future time, I will elaborate this, but at the moment I can only indicate it. The regular course of things is the development of the physical body up to the seventh year, of the etheric body up to the 14th year, and so on, up to the 28th year. Then, and only then, if conditions took a regular, straightforward course, would the I awaken in the mind-soul. For only then does the external organization of the human being contain the proper and suitable instrument for the eye. But the eye awakens, actually, at a very early period of childhood, quite independently of the external organization, at that point of time to which in later life the memory reaches back. Why is it that the birth of the eye, instead of occurring between the 28th and 35th years, in accordance with the development of man's external organization, actually occurs during the earliest years of childhood? It is because the luciferic forces have brought about a certain displacement as between the inner and the outer man. The luciferic forces are connected with retardation in time. The I within us is grounded upon luciferic forces, upon remembrance of what has remained to us of our experiences in life. Lucifer emancipates the I, which is thus made free and independent of the outer organization. For a time it was necessary for man to be connected externally with something other than his I alone. To maintain his rightful place it was necessary to form a link with a being who had lived during the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, had reached his 30th year, and was then inspired by the Christ, by a power which could not live on the earth beyond the 33rd year, but which in the 33rd year passed through death. To begin with, it was an external historical link. What I have often described to you from the one side, I want you now to consider from the inner side. The human being remembers back to the point in his life when consciousness awakens. His remembrance stretches back to the birth of the I, for his actual entrance into earth existence is shrouded in sleep. Of what precedes the birth of the I, we have to be told by our parents, by our elder brothers and sisters, by our seniors. Just as the memory of the human being now reaches back to the awakening of this I, the Luciferic I, so later on he will see as in an imagination another I before him. This will come about during the next 3,000 years as a development of great significance in the evolution of humanity. In the future, man will remember that at a certain point of time in his childhood, the Luciferic I awakened. And he will also remember back to another point of time when the Christ I appears, in contrast to the Luciferic I. Instead of the one point, there will be two. The fact that this will arise as a memory will be the proof that the Christ event is not still to take place, but that it has already taken place. In short, just as a person at the present time remembers back to the awakening of the I, so in time to come the imagination of the second I will be within his field of remembrance, enabling him to find the way to what we describe as the new appearance or manifestation of Christ. The fact that man is growing onward to new experiences, spiritual experiences of an entirely new kind, is something that must be understood in the light of spiritual science. For naturally, there must be preparation for these experiences. The human soul is moving toward new experiences. That is one thing that must be realized in spiritual science. The second is this. These new experiences are of such a nature that they will bring peace, concord, and harmony upon the earth and among men, and it will indeed be so. That is why it is such an overpowering experience to be able to understand the folk spirit in another corner of the earth. The poetry inspired by the folk spirit is illumined by spiritual science. But we must be willing to steep ourselves in what actually springs from this folk spirit and interpolate nothing else. That must be the attitude of a spiritual conception of the world. And now let us face facts. What is the present position? People have quarreled, have fought and shed blood through the ages over religious opinions. But if the root nerve of spiritual science is understood, there will be no more conflict in the future about particular religious opinions. People's minds will be directed to the spiritual facts themselves, and differences of opinion on the various problems of religion will exist just as they exist in other spheres, but not in such a way as to lead to bloodshed and strife. For it will be recognized that the revelations given to the different peoples point back to vast and mighty wisdom. Men will find the foundation and ground of this wisdom and recognize the truths that are contained in the various religions. The science of comparative religion has done far-reaching work in connection with the several religions and the points of resemblance to be found in them. Splendid results have been achieved. But what, in reality, is the attitude that is almost invariably adopted? The attitude, more or less, clearly expressed, is that all the religions are false. The science of comparative religion brings out the errors far more clearly than the truths contained in the religions. Spiritual science, on the other hand, directs its attention to the truths, to the initiation knowledge which they contain. To what does this lead? What, for instance, will be the attitude of a Christian to a Buddhist? The Christian will realize the sublimity and splendor of the Buddhist system, because Christianity itself will learn to understand reincarnation and karma. The Christian will recognize the greatness of this teaching of Buddhism. And he will have knowledge, too, of the existence of certain individualities in world evolution who rise from the rank of bodhisattva to that of Buddha. The Christian will understand something which spiritual development alone can make clear to him, namely that in the 29th year of his life, the son of King Suddhodana became the Buddha. The event could only take place at that particular age, as a study of spiritual science will show. These things are connected with what is said in the little book titled The Education of the Child. With this knowledge, the Christian will also realize that such a being does not descend again to earth in a physical body. Christians who are theosophists, or if you prefer, theosophists who are Christians, do not regard these teachings of Buddhism as mythical fables, but together with the Buddhists, believe in the truth that in his 29th year the Bodhisattva became Buddha and will not return in a physical body. The Christian respects this belief. He believes what the Buddhist believes, is at home on the soil of Buddhism, does not regard it as childish fantasy. He knows that in the royal son of King Suddhodana there dwelt an individuality who rose to such spiritual heights that he need never again descend into a physical body, but sends his influence in another way into the evolution of humanity. Understanding the truths contained in Buddhism, the Christian will never interfere in the spiritual life of a Buddhist in such a way as to alienate him from his religion. And what will be the attitude to Christianity of a Buddhist, who also happens to be a theosophist? He will try to grasp what it signified when, in a man known as Jesus of Nazareth, in the 30th year of his life, the I capital was replaced by the being whom the fourth post-Atlantean epoch of culture called the Christ, and who dwelt for 3 years in the body of Jesus of Nazareth. He will understand what is meant by saying that the substance of Christ, which passed through death with Christ Jesus, has streamed over human culture. And he will try to understand that this life, from the baptism by John in the Jordan to the mystery of Golgotha, represents an event which took place once and once only in the evolution of mankind, and that, like the Buddha, he who was once incarnate in Jesus of Nazareth can never again come down to the earth. The Christian, who is also a theosophist, understands that the Bodhisattva, having become Buddha, ascends into the spiritual worlds. The Buddhist, who is also a theosophist, recognizes those spiritual facts which form the essence of Christian belief, namely that the Christ being descended into the body of Jesus of Nazareth, lived in that body for 3 years, and passed through death, and that thereafter his power streams through the spiritual atmosphere of the earth. Mutual understanding among the confessions of faith on the earth, and therewith mutual harmony, that is the essence and core of theosophical teaching. If the Christians were to say that an individuality might appear as the reincarnated Buddha, it would be an absurdity, and the Buddhist people would rightly resist any such teaching being disseminated among them. Discord would inevitably arise in communities of Christians if they were informed that the Christ might incarnate again in the flesh. The task of theosophy is to bring about mutual understanding between the religions on earth, which are founded upon initiation. When this is understood, theosophy will live truly in the hearts of men. There will be no founding of new sects, no proclamations of new physical prophets, for whom humanity no longer waits in that external sense. People will then learn to understand the Rosicrucian principle, which has remained unbroken since the founding of Rosicrucianism, namely that those who are charged with the task of teaching may not previously speak to the outer world of their mission. Indeed, it is a venerable rule in Rosicrucianism that a teacher of the Rosicrucian way is never outwardly proclaimed as such by his contemporaries. The fact that he is such a teacher may not be spoken of until 100 years after his death, not before, because only so can the impersonal element be preserved in a genuine spiritual movement. Clear understanding of the fact that we are entering upon a phase of development in which the human soul will become more and more aware of the inflow of the spiritual, and thus of the supra-sensory Christ event of which we may speak prophetically, and a clear realization that theosophy must always lead to an understanding of what is sacred and holy to each individual. These are the two factors which make one a true theosophist within the theosophical movement. Indeed, a person's very attitude to them can tell us whether he has or has not understood the task of theosophy in the present age. The end of Lecture 4.